This is the takeaway for Monday, July 17th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. The 2016 election was a milestone for supporters of drug reform. Marijuana-related ballot measures passed in 8 different states. Now, overall, 29 states and the District of Columbia now have legalized marijuana for medicinal purposes. And 8 of those states, along with D.C., legalized marijuana for recreational use. But as more of those laws are being rolled out at the state level, they're being met by hostility from the Trump administration. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking to a National Association of AGs meeting back in February.
My view is that crime does follow drugs. I, as you know, am dubious about marijuana. As states, I get, can pass whatever laws they choose, but I'm not sure we're going to be a better, healthier nation that if we have marijuana being sold at every corner grocery store.
Now, earlier this year, Attorney General Jeff Sessions created a crime reduction task force. One of its missions was reviewing connections between federal marijuana sentencing and violent crime. The findings of that task force are expected to be published at the end of the month, but in the meantime, Sessions has gone to Congress. He's asked leaders there for legal permission to skirt around state marijuana laws and directly impose the existing federal ban. In just a minute, we're going to go to Nevada, which is experiencing a bumpy rollout of recreational marijuana legalization there, despite having a reluctant Republican governor. But first, Mark Kleiman is here. He's professor of public policy at the NYU Marin Institute of Urban Management, and he's here to talk about the line between state and federal enforcement. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
Mark, as we mentioned, more and more states are deciding that they want their marijuana laws loosened. You hear a very different message from Jeff Sessions there. Where exactly is the line now between state laws and what the federal government can do?
The federal law is valid everywhere. So all a state can do is change its state law. So it can create a state legal system, but it can't create a legal system. When my group worked with Washington State to set up their commercial cannabis system, I kept having to remind people that we were issuing state licenses to commit federal felonies. Nothing's changed about that. The question is to what extent the federal government can actually go after state legal activity. And the Obama administration decided that unless that activity impinged on 8 federal priorities, which it listed, it was not going to make that kind of enforcement a priority. And in the meantime, the Congress had actually forbidden the Justice Department to spend any money to interfere with state medical marijuana systems. So at least the medical side was somewhat protected, though the actual force of that law isn't clear. Early on, this administration indicated that they were going to take that fact as an indication that Congress did not want them enforcing against medical marijuana, but possibly go after the commercial side. Whether that reflects what's going to be the Justice Department's view or not, I don't know.
So it's clear legally in a state that has legalized recreational marijuana, let's say Colorado, that if a state regulates its sales and its shops and its taxes within the border of its state, that the Justice Department can still go in.
Absolutely. We run 2 different systems in this country. There are lots of things that are illegal under federal law that are not illegal under state law. And the problem that Eric Holder, as Attorney General under Obama, ran into is the same problem that Sessions is going to run into, which is the federal government does not have the horses to actually enforce its laws. 4,000 DEA agents cannot replace the work of 500,000 state and local cops. I think in the end, there's going to be a lot of bluffing, a lot of huffing and puffing, maybe a couple of symbolic cases. But I think the decision that the previous administration made was inevitable. This is federalism in action. The Congress has not given the federal government the money it needs to enforce its own laws, and therefore it relies on state and local cooperation. And if the states don't want to play, there's not a lot the feds can do about it.
Mark, the Supreme Court has already ruled on parts of this federalism debate around marijuana that you're talking about, the well-known case of Gonzales v. Raich.
Right.
Back in the late 90s or maybe early 2000s, I suppose. How far has that case gone in setting limits between what the federal government can do and what rights states have here?
Well, in that case, the question was around medical and whether the state could decide that something is medical, even though the federal government had decided that it wasn't, and the Supreme Court said no. I don't think anybody has doubted that the federal government can make cannabis illegal or make cannabis sales illegal. What the federal government could do if it wanted to is destroy the state legal systems. Right? Everybody in Colorado had to apply for a license to grow or to sell. Those applications are public records. The Justice Department could take those applications into federal district court and say, Your Honor, here are people who were applying for licenses to commit felonies. Please enjoin them from doing so. And those injunctions would issue, and then they could use the contempt power to shut down those stores. What they couldn't do is shut down the illegal market that would come back as a result because of the manpower problem. Cannabis is now a $40 billion a year illegal market. It's by far the largest of the illegal drug markets, big change from even 20 years ago. And I think we're now at the point where we were with alcohol prohibition around 1929. The system is simply falling apart under the pressure of the size of the illegal market and the unwillingness of anybody to spend the money to shut it down.
Well, Mark Klein, let's leave this with the politics around marijuana legalization, which have shifted drastically. I mean, 60% of Americans in a Quinnipiac poll now say marijuana should be legal. It's already a multi-billion dollar industry in the states that we've talked about. States are drawing millions in tax revenue. Banks want to get into the game. Why would Congress, knowing that many of their constituencies feel this way and many of their states are drawing so much money from the taxes, want to grant Jeff Sessions' request for a crackdown?
Notice that voters in a bunch of states have legalized cannabis for commercial, for non-medical use. No state legislature has done that. Again, even though it's quite popular, politically a lot more popular than, say, Donald Trump. But I think the number of politicians who want to be on the wrong side of law enforcement on a drug issue is not very large at the moment.
Mark Klein, professor of public policy at the NYU Marin Institute of Urban Management. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, one state that finds itself on the front lines of marijuana legalization is Nevada. Voters legalized recreational marijuana there in November. But on July 1st, when official sales were supposed to start, the state was unprepared for a huge demand. Tick Sagerbloom is a Nevada state senator who backed legalizing marijuana in his state. Senator, welcome.
Thank you.
Why wasn't the state prepared to meet all the demand for this newly legalized product?
We were. The rumors that we ran out of marijuana was not true. We had plenty of marijuana, and we still do. So anyone wants to come to Nevada, it's available in any kind of form you want.
Now, hang on. There were lots of stories written about how dispensaries ran out of marijuana, how there were disputes with alcohol distributors who were originally licensed to distribute. What happened?
Those stories got greatly exaggerated. What happened was the governor proposed a regulation, and because he wanted to expedite it, he called it an emergency regulation. And so the press went out that we were having an emergency because we were running out of marijuana. But that literally was not the truth. We have plenty of marijuana. We had some issues about delivery, but those issues have been resolved. And if you want to come to Nevada, trust me, you'll find whatever you want.
All right. Well, Senator, how much money does Nevada stand to gain in taxes and regulation here?
We're looking at over a two-year period, probably about $150 million.
What would you like to spend it on?
Well, most of it goes to education, but there's lots of other people, obviously, with their hand out. Our state is very poor. We have a poor tax structure, so everybody is always wanting more money. So trust me, there will be plenty of people who want it.
Yeah. I mean, does the law right now dictate that most of it goes to education?
Yes and no. The initiative passed by the voters requires that the money go to education that was passed, the tax that was part of that initiative. But in addition to that, we have an 18% tax that we as legislature adopted, and that money we have the flexibility with. Although, again, primarily we're going to send most of it to education.
So what does it look like now, Senator, in Las Vegas, in Reno, even in Searchlight, places like that? Are dispensaries popping up storefronts in strip malls?
No, we had an existing medical marijuana program, and so those dispensaries, which were serving the medical community, are now allowed to service recreational people. So we haven't got any new dispensaries. It's just the existing ones. Some of them are in shopping malls and things like that, but they've been there for a couple of years. So there's no, the average person wouldn't see any difference other than the fact that there might be a line outside the door.
Senator, we just spent some time talking about the potential for a new federal crackdown from the Trump administration, who does not like liberalizing marijuana laws in places like Nevada. Are officials or customers in your state worried about a federal crackdown, and has the uncertainty slowed you down at all?
Yes, we are worried, but no, it hasn't slowed us down. We basically are poking our finger in Trump and Sessions' eye and say, come get us. Because the initiative the voters passed last November didn't require us to go out with recreational till January. We brought it out 6 months early. So we're really going forward. We're keeping an eye on Washington, but we're basically saying, if you want to come to Nevada, you know, have at us, because we don't think you have the balls really to come after us.
So, Senator, you know, the two biggest expenses in almost any state budget are education and Medicaid. Those are the big ticket items that states have to pay for. We're watching a debate in Washington right now that may cut the federal contribution to Medicaid by billions, hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 20 years. And as a state lawmaker who's responsible for your state's budget, I wonder how important you think marijuana legalization will be for the long-term health of your state's budget.
You know, frankly, compared to Medicare and Medicaid, it's not that much money, or even education. It's a drop in the bucket. It's a significant amount, but it's still, you know, less than 5%. But the one thing you didn't mention, which is another part of our state budgets, is prison system. And the fun thing about marijuana is not only do you get revenue, but you also take people out of the prison system, out of the correction system, out of the criminal justice system, which saves a ton of money. So there's a lot of ancillary benefits that people don't even think about when you legalize marijuana.
Do you think this is a good way, though, to make drug policy in your state or other states? I mean, we have an FDA in Washington, experts who worry about safety and effectiveness for drugs. Nevada doesn't vote to legalize one heart medication over another, or one weight loss medication over another. It's just not how we do it. Why should we do it with marijuana?
Well, the reality is marijuana has been out there being used since I was using it in the 60s and before that. It's one of those things where Washington, D.C. policymakers are so far behind the curve, both as far as policy and as far as the public. You know, the public likes this drug. They use this drug. And the fact that it would be criminalized is really insane. And we waited and waited and waited for the federal government to take action. They didn't. Finally, the states are one by one stepping up and saying, we're going to do it anyway. So sometimes, you know, you just have to take the bull by the horns, and that's what states are doing. And I think this is just one example, but lots of other areas. And, of course, Trump is so far removed from where this country is going. He's a throwback to the 50s. So the states are where all the action is, and we're just going to go forward with what we think is best policy. And at some point, hopefully, D.C. will catch up with us.
Tick Sagerblum, Democratic State Senator in Nevada. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, providing legal answers to the day-to-day questions of small business owners through its network of independent attorneys, available nationwide. More information at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. You know, there are times when President Trump's Twitter feed doesn't match White House policy, or when policy utterances from the White House disappear, never to be seen again. Think maybe the president's suggestion a month ago that he'd like to impose new taxes on the internet? That one kind of disappeared from public view pretty quickly. But one place where the president has been very clear and very consistent is his desire to eliminate government regulations.
We have begun a historic program to reduce the regulations that are crushing our economy, crushing. And not only our economy, crushing our jobs, because companies can't hire. We're going to put the regulation industry out of work and out of business.
That was the president speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference in February. During his first year in office, the president has directed government agencies to assemble deregulation task forces. And their job is to identify and roll back regulations that are deemed harmful to business. Our partners at the New York Times recently teamed up with ProPublica to find out who the members of these agency deregulation task forces are and who they've been meeting with. Now, most of the agencies that they contacted did not want to identify who was working on these deregulation task forces. But once reporters were able to get some names, they found a number of political appointees with potential conflicts of interest. Danielle Ivory is here. She's with the New York Times. She co-authored the report, and she joins me to discuss her findings. Danielle, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I read in your report along with ProPublica that you managed to dig up 71 names, including 28 with potential conflicts of interest. Who are some of these people?
Well, you're right. So we were able to dig up about 71 names and found that about 28 had these potential conflicts. And some of them were coming from the lobbying world and had been registered to lobby agencies that they're now at and are tasked with looking for regulations that could be eliminated or streamlined or rolled back. We also have people from industries that have been trying to roll back regulations, who work for employers who were trying to roll back regulations or had clients that were trying to change regulations at the agencies that they're now at. And then we also had people who were coming from other government jobs who might have sort of an ideological bent that is more in line with the Trump administration, more in line with a classic Republican administration that wants a smaller government. We didn't really look at those people as having potential conflicts. That's not what we're talking about. But we did identify them just so that the public would know who is coming into these positions and is going to be eyeing the regulations that affect them on a daily basis.
Now, you also said in a couple of cases you found people who stand to directly profit in businesses that they're moving to deregulate now.
Right, right. And it's potential. I mean, you know, we found some names that raised a little bit of a red flag. So, for example, we found a man named Byron Brown. He's on the EPA's deregulation task force, and his wife works for a company called Hess Corporation, which is an oil and gas corporation, and they are very directly affected by the EPA and their rules. And we wanted to know whether Mr. Brown and his wife owned any Hess stock. We were not able to get an answer on that. Also, Mr. Brown's wife's company, Hess, is part of a trade association that has actually already started lobbying the deregulation team directly. So that seemed to be an instance where there was the potential for personal profit.
So that's one deregulation advisor at the EPA and his spouse. What are some other examples throughout the government?
Well, there was one example in particular that really jumped out at us. So you mentioned before agencies were not particularly forthcoming about their deregulation task forces. We asked for names. We thought that would actually be a pretty easy thing to get and ended up being stonewalled at several agencies. We also asked for correspondence and calendars because we wanted to know who these people are talking with and who they're meeting with. And we FOIA'd all of the major agencies for this and got very, very little back, if anything at all. But we were able to get our hands on hundreds of pages of visitor logs, like handwritten visitor logs that you would see in like the lobby of an office building at the Department of Interior's headquarters. So Robert Federici, my ProPublica counterpart and reporting partner on this, we split those up and went through and looked at every single meeting that a Department of Interior task force member had with someone outside of the department. And we backgrounded all of those people, anyone who's name we could read because some of the handwriting was very messy. And we ended up finding a woman named Laura Peterson, who happens to be a top lobbyist for a pesticide company called Syngenta. She met with a man named Scott Cameron, who is a newly minted official at the Department of Interior. And he happened to come from a nonprofit that he founded that got money from Syngenta. That was one of the first meetings that he took at the Department of Interior.
So that's Scott Cameron, one example, who you found you had to go into visitor logs and messy handwriting to get all this.
Yes.
And Danielle, I mean, you mentioned 71 cases with around 30 people who may have conflicts, and that suggests strongly that there are many more examples out there since you had such a hard time getting this information. You've put a call out to readers to help with this, to sort of crowdsource finding members of these deregulation task forces. What do you want them to do?
Well, we would love for people who work in government or interact with these task forces in some way to get in touch with us and tell us what's going on, what they're looking at, what their priorities are, who they're meeting with. And you can reach us at taskforce@nytimes.com or taskforce@propublica.org. And Robert and my signal numbers are on both websites as well if you want to get us through encrypted chat.
Have you gotten any bites so far?
A lot, yes.
A lot of bites coming in. So this crowdsourcing is starting to work.
Yeah, more brains are better than one.
Danielle Ivory at the New York Times and her partners at ProPublica are putting out the call to federal agencies, to people who work with federal agencies. What are you hearing? Who are they meeting with? If those agencies aren't being forthcoming with the people's information, well, you go right to the source. Danielle Ivory, reporter with the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Deregulation of big businesses like banks or fossil fuel companies and who's doing that regulation can sometimes miss a different story going on in cities and towns all across the country. Many small business owners are excited by the prospect of President Trump delivering on his promise to deregulate industry and make it easier for them to do business. Brian Keller is with me now. He's president and CEO of Keller Logistics Group. They're a trucking company in Defiance, Ohio. Brian, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
Brian, how many employees at the Keller Logistics Group?
We have 370 employees.
Does that qualify as a small business? That sounds like a pretty big small business.
Good question. I think in the government size, we'd be considered small.
So what are the big regulations that affect you? You're a trucking concern, right?
Yes, we are. Trucking and warehousing. So, you know, with us, it's getting a workforce into our industry. And, you know, you can't drive a truck on federal highways until you're 21 years old, which is a large gap from when you graduate from high school to get to the age to drive a semi.
Oh, so one regulation that you would like to see changed is to lower that age to 18, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. When those regulations were put into place, probably back in the 80s when we supposedly deregulated, you know, trucks were different back then, roads were different back then. Today, we have cameras in our trucks, we have automatic transmissions, we have safety assistance with collision avoidance, lane departure, and stuff like that. It's easier to drive a truck, and we have the cameras, which we can tell if you're a good driver or not a good driver.
You know, Brian, trucking rules have been a huge debate kind of below the radar in Washington for a lot of years, and there are lots of new rules now about the number of hours a trucker can drive continuously, the number of miles, you got to get off the road and rest for a certain amount of time. Can you explain how these rules affect your business and how you might like to see them changed?
I support most of those rules. You know, our drivers are allowed to drive 11 hours, work a total of 14 hours a day. I don't think the rules need changed a whole lot. What we need is consistency throughout the states of having the same rules. There's different rules in California than there are in Ohio, and just makes it hard to comply when you're an interstate trucking company.
So, Brian, what's your biggest hope from President Trump's promise to deregulate industries, including the trucking industry? Where can you save the most money? You mentioned the age of drivers. What else?
Other than that, I think what he's done, slowing down the Department of Labor and some of the rules that they were putting through, they had the change in overtime exemption, you know, for exempt employees. They over doubled that amount to almost $47,000. That's a lot of money out in the Midwest. You know, a more gradual approach to increasing that makes a whole lot of sense, which he's already stopped that. They had the fair paycheck rule, which, you know, we think we're paying everyone appropriately, but, you know, we were going to have to, you know, hire a consultant to come in and go through all of our pay practices and structure to make sure everything was done right in case the federal government decided to target us. You know, 16 or 17 year old kids, you can drive a car, but you can't drive a forklift. Now, wouldn't it be better if we were employing our kids, you know, on a part-time basis, training them with some sort of apprenticeship to be welders, forklift drivers, which then could eventually become truck drivers, you know, or other industries. But instead, you have to play video games and work in fast food restaurants and can't get out there and learn a trade like construction or welding or plumbing because federal laws won't allow us, and some state laws, to employ our kids and train them a skill.
A view on deregulation from Defiance, Ohio, and the small business of Brian Keller, president and CEO of Keller Logistics Group. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
Somos un solo pueblo. Somos una sola nación. Y que viva la paz.
We are one people. We are one nation. And may peace live. That was Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos last month celebrating the end of the decades-long conflict with the FARC insurgency. The peace deal was a victory, but now it's caused new problems in Colombia. FARC controlled huge swaths of Colombian jungle for much of their 52-year insurgency and required civilians on that land to maintain forest cover. But now that FARC is demobilized, there's a power vacuum as farmers and industry move in to clear the land. As a result, deforestation jumped by some estimates as much as 44% in 2016. Adrian Alsima is editor-in-chief of Columbia Reports, the largest English-language publication in Colombia. He says government promises to protect the land have been ineffective, and militant groups have already moved in and set up illegal mining and logging operations.
Well, there are FARC dissidents, particularly in central Colombia. They are very prominent. And these dissident groups are trying to take over the FARC's old criminal records. And they don't have the old MO that the FARC used. At the same time, there's remnants of the old paramilitary groups, and they are also moving in. But the biggest thing is just lawlessness. So people who individually go and lumber and so coca, illegal mining and that type of stuff.
So what does it mean when these industries pour in and there's a power vacuum, or at least a vacuum of security in these places? What happens to a forested area?
Well, it doesn't just affect the forest. These groups are basically in low power turf wars. The killing of social leaders has gone up since the FARC demobilized. And the deforestation is one of those things that happened in that power vacuum that a large part of the country is in at the moment.
The FARC rebels, when they occupied the forest for all these years, strictly prohibited any deforestation. I always thought that that was because this was their cover. This was their security, and they didn't want their ability to blend in to be compromised.
Well, the FARC have always been like pretty hypocrite in regards to environmental control. Like they would allow coca cultivations, but would tax the coca farmers. But they would definitely not allow poaching or illegal lumbering, because indeed it was their cover. So now that they're gone, it's open season.
But Adrian Alsima, there were plenty of groups warning that this would happen, right? That there was no plan to avoid deforestation or to avoid lawlessness. And if you took away the FARC constant, that this might happen.
And it's even more embarrassing that the military and the FARC have been coordinating the FARC's demobilization since December 2014. So the time to prepare the FARC's abandonment of these regions has been pretty ample. But the military is just failing to move in. And the reasons are yet unknown. But my guess is that it's just the weak and corrupt state system that's always been a problem in Colombia.
It might also suggest, if there are business interests or coca cultivation going on in these areas, that the military may be profiting.
Absolutely. The military has long been corrupt. There's even allegations that the military was trafficking coca together with the FARC instead of combating them. So in some areas, members of the military would have criminal interests in that region.
So what's the plan now? Has the government come up with a good way of addressing the issue?
Well, the National Army is undergoing a major reform. All the commanders are being replaced of almost all divisions, and literally all the brigades. The military calculates that it needs about 10 years to fully stabilize the security situation in the country, and particularly in those areas. And the United Nations, which is overseeing the peace process, has made it a priority to first make those areas where the FARC once ruled safe again and basically under the rule of law.
Adrián Alsima, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Adrián Alsima is editor-in-chief of Colombia Reports. Deforestation in Colombia is one of just many environmental problems in the country, and confrontations are increasingly common. In 2016, 37 people were killed protesting or defending against environmental degradation in Colombia alone. That's according to Global Witness, a nonprofit organization that tracks and investigates environmental and human rights abuses. Meanwhile, Global Witness recorded 200 killings of what they call environmental defenders around the world in 2016, and the number of deaths this year is on pace to exceed that mark. Global Witness has teamed up with The Guardian to chronicle these killings and expose what they say is a hidden crisis. Gillian Caldwell is the CEO of Global Witness, and she joins me now from London. Gillian, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Who are the people being killed, and why do you suspect this rise in the number of killings?
Well, the people being killed are people that are protecting their land and their natural world from industries like mining, logging, and agribusiness. And our statistics indicate that almost 40% of those murdered are indigenous people. And the reason that we're seeing this increasing rise in the number of threats and, of course, the killings that we're documenting is because the scramble for natural resources is intensifying around the world. And increasingly, industries are encroaching onto previously untouched areas rich in resources.
So competition for resources, that makes some sense. It's not a new phenomenon. You know, on this show last year, we covered the story of Chico Mendes, murdered in 1988 in Brazil, an environmental protester and protector. Are tactics from local interests getting more violent, more aggressive, or are there just more places of confrontation because of this competition for resources that you mentioned?
Well, it's hard to describe exactly why we're seeing more and more killings, but it surely doesn't help that people can operate with utter impunity in so many of these countries around the world. What most typically happens is that industries and potentially industries in collusion with governments are trying to reach into previously uncharted terrain, and they're doing so without the so-called free, prior, and informed consent of the communities onto whose land they're encroaching. And that's an obligation under international law, is to make sure that communities are consulted with respect to how their land is developed and evolved. So people are progressing onto land without this free, prior, and informed consent, and then protecting their interests really at any price. And because there is no accountability for these murders and people can operate with utter impunity, business as usual progresses.
What industries are usually in question here? You mentioned mining, but what others?
The top offenders are mining, logging, and agribusiness, and hydropower is also up there amongst the top. So our data suggests that it's these industries that require the most scrutiny and the most reform when it comes to this kind of behavior.
And the governments in question, where are we looking? The case, of course, of Chico Mendes was in Brazil in the 80s. What other regions, what other countries are the biggest problem?
Well, as you mentioned at the outset, we documented 200 killings in 2016, the deadliest year yet. Of those, the majority, in fact, 49 of the killings took place in Brazil. Colombia was second place with 37 killings. And Honduras and Nicaragua are also high on the scale alongside Philippines and India.
And 98 killings so far this year, as you've documented, Gillian, along with The Guardian, on pace to break a grim record. What about accountability in these countries with the governments you mentioned? Have there been any answers for why this is increasingly common?
Well, that's one of our, I mean, we're asking people to respond in three different ways. One is tackle the root causes of the risk, guarantee that communities can make free and informed choices about whether and how their land is used. Secondly, support and protect offenders through specific laws, policies, and practices. And third, ensure accountability for these kinds of abuses, going beyond prosecuting just those responsible for ordering and carrying an attack, but ensuring that we look behind the scenes to see who may actually be ultimately responsible. And we're still not seeing that kind of accountability.
You documented the case of one activist in Honduras, April Berta Caceres, who won the world's largest prize for grassroots environmentalists before her murder. Can you give me a sense of what her life was like, what she endured, and what her activism was like before she was killed?
Berta had been, very strongly opposing the construction of a massive new dam near her home, and she had received innumerable threats prior to her assassination. In fact, more than 30 threats against her life. And what's stunning about it is that the banks behind those loans never spoke out, notwithstanding the fact that those threats were very, very publicly covered, and it was obvious that her life was endangered.
So what's the answer to changing a culture in countries where there's so much money to be made and so much competition for environmental resources?
Well, beyond our calls to tackle the root causes of the risk and to support and protect offenders and to ensure accountability for these kinds of abuses, the real question is, why is it that the price these companies and governments are paying for this murderous behavior isn't high enough to deter them from doing so? You have to figure there's a behind-the-scenes calculation going on that these lives are dispensable. So you have a profit-at-any-price mentality, and I think ultimately these kinds of choices, this kind of behavior is going to have to become more expensive in order to get companies that are driven purely by profit to behave differently. For example, the insurance risk industry would be refusing to offer insurance where companies want to progress into high-risk zones, such as the ones we're describing. For example, financiers would be insisting that companies have processes in place to protect offenders and would be declining investment in situations where those kinds of protections weren't in place. Those are the kinds of changes we need to see, where the global marketplace responds and recognizes business as usual cannot progress in the way that it has been.
200 killings of environmental activists around the world in 2016 alone, nearly 100 in 2017 so far. Gillian Caldwell and Global Witness are at work with The Guardian exposing these killings and trying to bring some accountability for them. Gillian Caldwell, CEO of Global Witness from London, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Singer Nika Costa got her start at a very young age. She did her first recording with Hawaiian great Don Ho at age 5, and then after that, next to a very famous pair of blue eyes.
To love a child.
Mm-hmm. Said the bigger to the smaller raccoon, do you need someone?
That's Nika Costa at just 9 years old, singing a duet with Frank Sinatra. Her father was music producer and composer Don Costa. He worked with Sinatra for years. Nika Costa found fame as a child performer, recording a successful pop album before she even graduated high school, and then moving toward a more soulful, Motown-inspired style. She's toured with Lenny Kravitz, with Britney Spears, even with Prince, and she's back with her first full-length album in 6 years. It's called Underneath and In Between. Nika Costa joined me to talk about her career and the childhood that started it all.
As a kid, I was just around it. I just grew up in it, and it was kind of just my norm, just because that was my dad's job. And so, you know, his friends were musicians, and, you know, we'd have Sammy Davis Jr. over for barbecues, or, you know, Dinah Washington, or... So the caliber of performers and musicians was amazing. And then the personalities, you know, obviously were pretty cool. But as a kid, you don't really clock that, you know, it's still your parents' friends. So really all you want them to do is like throw you in the pool or like, you know, kind of watch you do shows or, you know, kind of what all kids want their parents, friends to do.
So you've got your new album out, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but you've got so much interesting music in your history before we get to the present day. You're a woman who had a relationship with Prince. We have to talk about that.
I mean, it was just one of those amazing gifts that comes around in your life that you don't expect and you don't kind of count on ever happening. I was a huge fan, obviously, growing up. And anyhow, I released Everybody Got Their Something in 2001. And he kind of reached out through the internet in his way of, you know, saying, Hanika, do you want to come to the park and play with us? So we went to Paisley, and I didn't even think I was going to meet him. I just thought, oh, it's like, you know, just like a gig. You just go and do the gig. And anyhow, he was there, and he was helping us, you know, with our gear and the sound, and he was super cool. And he took me on a tour, just him and I, around Paisley, and I got to pick his brain, and I was super nervous and, you know, definitely freaking out.
This is you and Prince together in Live at the Aladdin Las Vegas from the concert film in 2003. Nika Costa, by this time you had already partied with Prince at Paisley Park for his birthday, so clearly this was not a biggie.
It was a total biggie. Anytime he rang, I mean, we were, you know, friends for, you know, 15 years, and anytime he rang and wanted to do something was always a huge rush and nerve-wracking joy. That was what you just played was the first time we ever played on stage together. Since then, we'd played many times, but it really is all you can do just to keep it together. It's cuckoo.
Yeah. Well, he honored you by playing your song when he was on tour, whether you knew it or not. You covered one of his big hits. Sinead O'Connor made Nothing Compares to You a massive hit, but you had your own version of it.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away.
We'd been playing these shows at Largo in L.A. here, and this live show turned into this record, Underneath and In Between, with the strings. And then, unfortunately, as we were doing these shows, he passed away, and then it became even more kind of charged energetically and emotionally, for me, of course, singing it, but also for the audience that would come in and hear it, because, you know, we were all mourning in our own ways his passing.
Well, the new album, Nika Costa, is Underneath and In Between. We mentioned it before. I had read that you recorded this in just a day. Is it possible?
It is. Isn't that nuts? It is. I did a crowdfund music campaign to raise money to make this record. And, you know, we luckily got our goal in a week, and we're in the studio, and we had a day. We had 24 hours to make this whole record. So we did each song two or three times and then moved on to the next song.
Well, let's hear some of the fruits of this hasty but very caringly prepared job you did in the studio on the new album. This is Come Rain or Come Shine.
'Cause I'm gonna be true if you let me. You're gonna love me like nobody's loved me. Come rain or come shine.
This is an old Sinatra classic, and I read that you dug up one of your dad's old arrangements for this.
Yeah, I stumbled across it in my office. I was cleaning out my office before we started these shows, and I was moving a shelf. And underneath this shelf was this 60-piece orchestra arrangement wrapped in plastic that I don't remember ever seeing there, or I don't have very many things of my dad's, and it was this kind of weird find. And I called Jeff Babko, my pianist and arranger, and I said, Jeff, like, can you come over here and check this out? Like, what is this, you know? So we pulled up Sinatra's rendition, which my dad did arrange for Sinatra. And it was the actual arrangement. And I was blown away. And I said, Jeff, like, can you rearrange this and squash it down to, you know, our humble little quartet? And I always sing his praises because he really did such a beautiful job kind of keeping the integrity and the chords and the harmony of Dad's work. And then, you know, obviously made it possible for us to be able to play it. So it's very, very, very special.
The new album is Underneath and In Between from Nick Acosta. Nick Acosta, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we want to leave you with some big pop culture news from the weekend. The BBC has announced a new lead actor for the long-running British sci-fi show Doctor Who. Now, back in the 60s, the original Doctor, who was actor William Hartnell, he wanted to leave the show, but the BBC didn't want to lose their hit program, so they came up with a solution. Their alien main character would regenerate into a completely new person. The Doctor has regenerated 12 times in 54 years, always into a man, until now. Yesterday, the BBC announced that Jodie Whittaker will be the 13th Doctor. Whittaker starred in the crime drama Broadchurch, and after the 2017 Christmas special, will now take over the helm of the time-traveling TARDIS. The space-time continuum is in your hands, Jodie, and remember, Daleks don't care what form you take. That's extermination. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.